Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had
Well, no bank stocks and jacks. I'm Tom Alexander on the board. S&P futures down 8, NASDAQ futures up 50. Dow futures down 171. So we don't like the stinking Dow. We got oil up 222. That's up to 95.98. It was down to 85 a few days ago. So that's probably not a good thing. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, good morning.
How are you? Here I'm reading. I'm reading about.
I've got to go back to work today.
Is that good?
Well, it's good that I'm able.
It's good. Always, it's good that you're able and you have a job to go to. So,
I have a job that I love doing. So,
well, that's you've got three things going for you, but which I'm going to say most people do not. So that's a good thing.
There you have it. But yep, yeah, had throat surgery on Monday. That went well. So
this is the second of two. So you're done with that?
It's round three, and round four will be in December.
Well, there you go. I hope they don't have to put you out for this.
I say December, September.
Yeah, I hope they don't have to put you out every time, do they?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well. All right, well. By the way, I'm reading an article here that tells me that your homeowner's insurance has gone up. Did I really need to read this article to know that?
No, mine hasn't, actually, so.
Really?
That's yeah.
The average insurance premium jumped 24%. Between 2021 and 2024.
Oh, well, it's gone up in recent years, but it hasn't gone up lately.
Okay, but I'm saying that's a number. You never actually make up for this, do you? I mean, it's not like the CPI decides to adjust all this and say, really, we've been wrong for 20 years. It's up 30%, and by the way, your Social Security will be up 30% next month. Don't worry. I don't think we're doing that, are we?
Best I can tell, no.
No, it's a... We never kind of do a do-over on this stuff. You know, I was reading an article yesterday, and it's kind of a stuff we've talked about by and large for a while, and it's kind of a, help me with this. There's kind of like an attitude that goes towards sports, and especially when, you know, people love watching. They really don't care if anybody gets hurt or they have 20 surgeries later in life. I mean, I don't know why people are like that, because you and I are not like that. Maybe because we knew people that played and we knew the toll that was being taken, even in the college level. I just wonder how much... Let me explain to you the article that Sigmi at Effort is Rat, right? I was reading this article about the NCAA new playoffs. Is the 24-team playoff this year or next year? I don't even know. Is it this year or next year in football?
Is it a done deal? You know, I don't even know that it's a done deal yet.
I
think they're expanding to 16 first.
Okay, because I guess the new, is he the commissioner of the NCAA? Whoever the hell is in charge of the NCAA? There's a new guy there, and evidently his shtick was that he's very pro-player and pro-student and all this stuff. Well, evidently, according to this article... He's on board with this eventual 24-team playoff deal, and they're gonna end up not having the conference championships, which you and I thought were kind of useless for a while. But the crummy teams that get in at the lower level and have essentially to play in games could play as many as 17 games, kind of a lot. And on the one hand, he supposedly has a shtick where he's concerned about the players, but the drive from you know, from the TV, from the gamblers, from anybody else, is just kind of overwhelming. And pretty much can't, it's a stream you can't dam up, essentially. And boy, you know, but my question is, Kevin, is, you know, when we were younger, a long time ago we were younger, but even though people played college ball and got, you know, some benefit out of it, and he also got injured doing it, but I'm talking about football, maybe not baseball and the other stuff. And there was some attempt to, I don't know where we want to say it, in pretty much every broadcaster in people's minds to say, hey, these are 20-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids, some 18. And, you know, you'd have to, you know, they'd always show some parents. They do some sort of shtick. But once people got into the pros, I think the overwhelming attitude, and I'm not accusing you of this or me or the listeners, the overwhelming attitude is, we know these guys are beating the shit out of each other. We know they may maybe live less long, but so what? They're making 10 times more money than I ever hoped to make, and they're famous and I'm not. I don't give a crap what happens to them. I mean, that I think, you know, it's a gross generalization, but I think that's the attitude among a lot of people.
Well, you know what? That's even the attitude amongst a lot of the athletes themselves, where many of them ask point blank, you know, if this is shortening your life, or if it has shortened your life, you know, the general response is, yeah, but it was worth it. I understand the mindset, actually, because, you know, they're raised as competitors, and these are incredibly, you know, especially people who make it to the top leagues at the professional level are just incredibly competitive people. So I don't want to be overly dismissive of their mindset. I get it, but it is a willingness to sacrifice health in exchange for doing what they do. So to me, it would be no wonder that the fans would glom onto the same kind of attitude.
Well, I think that, I mean, everybody, if you look at history, and I'm certainly not just saying this is males, because obviously some ladies have had jobs that weren't that safe, but I mean, males have done this forever. I mean, people were never dumb enough to think that, you know, the high scaler job at Hoover Dam was as safe as, you know, working in the hardware aisle of the Sears store. I mean, I don't think anybody was that stupid. Yet the high scaler made three times as much as the guy in the Sears store. I mean, people have always been willing to put their health on the line for more money. A lot of times it's for their family or maybe for themselves. It's not like they, you know, they went out and bought fancy cars. I mean, but maybe your family, you want, whatever it was. I mean, people, dangerous jobs usually always paid more, right? And people were not dumb enough to realize that that wasn't part of the deal. Like, right? Am I right or not? I mean, it's...
Yeah. You know, one of the highest paying jobs out there was, being like a riveter on skyscrapers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean... And, you know, it's
about that high in the air and handle heavy equipment. Damn, we're going to pay you a lot for that. Because there aren't that many people that are willing to do it for little.
But I guess where I'm going with this, and I want your opinion, more than your opinion, your counsel, as we start dropping this down in age, how fair is it? I mean, right now, if everybody starts looking at a college kid is not an 18-year-old student who happens to play football, but some money-grubbing suck just like he's in the NFL. And if he's willing to get paid 20 weeks a year and have 50 knee surgeries before he's 40, that's his problem, not mine. I'm betting on him. I don't give a crap. And even down to the high school level, you know, to where if kids are starting getting paid in high school, well, you know, what do I even care about them? But at some point, you get down to a number where it's almost child labor laws. I mean, somebody going to high school, I mean, I meeting with a fellow tonight who's good, who's a, people in his family happen to be terrific athletes. They're being courted before high school, for God's sake, with free camps in the summer and everything else. We're talking about they're 15, they're 14. I mean, they're not even legal, for God's sake. I mean, how low are we willing to go? I mean,
pretty low, because first of all, that's not especially new. This this is not like a 20-year phenomenon. It's more like a 30 or 40-year phenomenon that people have been, you know, doing the free camp stuff and courting the kids in high school, you know, getting them into the AAU programs run by people who, you know, make money off of them. So that that part's not new. The other part that's not new is the failure to look out for the welfare of the athletes themselves, the young athletes. And you know, case in point, even back when you and I were in high school, there were people who just abused in all summer long would abuse a pitcher's arm.
Yeah.
And just, you know, because in those days there were high school summer leagues, there was American Legion, and then there were the town leagues and traveling teams and so on. You know, you would have some of these kids pitching, especially the pitchers, on three teams, and not one of these coaches gave a damn about, you know, how much you pitched on your other teams as well, and limiting the number of pitches you threw. So I don't think it's new. I just think it's more, you know, it's kind of followed, you know, the money. First of all, the access to information has made it more obvious to the rest of us when it's been happening for a long time. But two is the amount of money involved has sort of changed the flavor of the whole thing.
Well, I think it's changed it dramatically. And if I think of a kid at Notre Dame, for instance. I'll give you an example. How I remember this kind of stuff, Kevin, I don't know. But years ago, I used to go to the barber on 95th Street. Joe, this Italian guy. This is back when you could go to the barber and get a bet down at a track, right? You know, I was a young guy. Well, the people next door was a law firm. I forget the name of the place. But from what I understand, you know, there were a couple of good lawyers. I don't know what the hell they did. You know, traffic and stuff, probably. I don't know, wills. But, you know, one guy was a pretty tough, athletic guy. And his kid was a good ball player. And I don't know if he was at Rice or Evergreen Park or someplace. So Bo Schembechler shows up at the law firm. And these guys are doing pretty well. And, you know, it's right about the time, I'm going to say, maybe 1980-something, whenever the hell Bo was still coaching. And he's in there and he's trying to recruit the kid, and the old man's listening to him. And Bo says to the guy, "Let's just make one thing perfectly clear." And the guy goes, "Well, what's that?" And he goes, "I own your son for 4 years." And the guy looks at Bo and he says, "Bo, nobody owns my son for 4 years. You don't. And oh, by the way, for the $4,000 in tuition that I could easily pay, you surely don't owe him. So get the bleep out of here," to kick them out. And, I mean, but the money now it's a $70,000 tuition, and we're paying your kid $150,000 a year to sit behind the starting tackle. Somehow that has changed, but the kid's still 17. You know, really unable to even sign that contract. Something weird's going on, Kevin. It's a matter of degree. You know what I'm saying? If you and I want to.
I think that's. I think that's. You know, you and I are saying the same thing, because it is a matter of degree. You know, the nature of it has changed. The stakes, the monetary stakes are higher. So all those are absolutely factors in the equation. So it's same game, but you know, same game played for higher stakes.
I think at some point it becomes not the same game. You know, I don't know. And I don't know where that line is. This is kind of a fundamental disagreement I have with maybe a few people on the. I mean, you and I know that if somebody is, you know, selling some hooch, we know guys did that out of their dorm room. You know, they'd buy a lid and have part of it, or a bite. When you buy it, you buy it, what, the pound, and you count it up at how many ounces, and you smoked one and you sold the rest to break even out of your dorm room. And we knew guys that did that.
I think I did know guys who did that.
But I mean, you can say it's the same thing as standing in the middle of the street in an orange jacket and selling to anybody comes by, even kids. But to me, it's not the same thing. It's sort of the same thing, but it's not really the same thing. I mean, one is, you know, I mean, yes, you're selling marijuana. I get that part, but it's at a level where you all of a sudden are totally different with the product, I think. And I don't know where the line is there, but I think there's a huge difference.
Yeah, but from many coaches' standpoints on that, I don't think it's all that different. In fact, you know, there were payouts involved, and you know there was a lot going on under the table that was there too. Again, you know, it's more widespread because it's easy to make it widespread now.
I think that Eric Parsegian making $60,000 a year, possibly breaking the rule and giving a kid $50 for the Greyhound ticket for his uncle's funeral is a lot different than today. In principle, yeah. I guess it's, you know, it isn't, but it sure as hell to me is.
I remember Digger Phelps talking about the price tag for LaFonso Ellis that other schools were bidding before he decided to choose Notre Dame. And, you know, he, at the time he was saying just to get him to sign on the dotted line was, you know, in the $20,000 range. So that was a long time ago.
Yeah, but, you know,
What I'm saying is that, you know, the money was getting thrown around, and it was big money in many cases. It was getting thrown around at the time. However, what was big money then, what's big money now are two different things. And like I said, it's more in the open now than it ever was. And, you know, in some ways that's good in that it's at least transparent. But honestly, I don't begrudge the athletes anything they can make. I absolutely do not. I think for years, and we've talked about this on the show for, you know, I don't know, as long as I've been involved, you know, that the deck has been stacked in favor of the schools, and it probably still is to a large degree.
Oh, yeah, I think it is too, yeah.
You know, I mean, we're sort of crying. It's like Title IX. People would bitch about Title IX, but don't you dare start talking about taking it away. Because as soon as you take it away, you're going to, you know, it's part of the justification for the current business models.
Well, I mean, I have this issue this way.
What I'm saying is, we're doing now is we've added really big money, and really out there for a lot of people to see. And we've added that to a business model that was created decades ago. And it's not handling it well. It's not handling it well at all.
But you're also dropping down in age to the point where, I mean, one of my good buddies is he's on the board, I'll say a very serious Catholic football high school here. And he says now, any kid that comes in where the parents think he's got some talent and the parents are, you know, jumping in on this full bore, but not, unlike the lawyer I was talking about who could easily have paid the $4,000 and told Bo Schembler to get his ass out of the office, now it's $80,000 in tuition and $150,000. If the kid doesn't get this, he's probably not going to go to school, at least at that level, right, because the parent doesn't have it. So, but he says the biggest discussion is kids showing up as a freshman is my kid's probably going to get a ride to a college. Can he graduate in December of his senior year without even getting his first C or B or A or F? And that's already in the discussion. And the kids, what do you go when you go to college? Is he 15? 14? I mean, we're already planning on this. I mean, there is, again, I'm stumbling, I'm not arguing with you regarding the degree, but at some point it becomes degree. I mean, the little bar in Michigan City, I don't know if it's still even open, must have been a Notre Dame bar, the guy's got to be long dead, or his grandfather's probably dead. If you go in there, they have all the different season totals for Notre Dame when, like, Leahy was the coach, 48, 49, 50. Okay, Kevin, the kids had a summer job. They showed up a week before the other students, maybe 10 days for some sort of a camp. They played till Thanksgiving, so they played like 8 or 9 games, maybe. 9 was probably the tops, and they didn't go to a bowl game. That's a totally different world than maybe 17 games for an 18-year-old. Would have to work out all summer, can't get a summer job. I mean, we're talking about, I'm just saying, are we deciding, we, the gamblers and the people who love watching it, are we deciding that 18-year-olds now have to go through this because we want them to or because they want to? I mean, where are we here on this?
I think in most cases, I think you find some of each of those, and you do hear the stories about the kid who says, I just want to walk away from it. I can't do this any longer. And there are plenty of those situations out there. So, that factors in. I think it also factors in that we are talking about in some cases, some really bad parenting or misdirected parenting, let's put it that way, where you have, you know, parents who are pushing this. They're seeing the dollar signs, and they're not necessarily seeing the dollar signs for the kid as much as they're seeing them for themselves or for the family or for whatever, but not necessarily looking out for the best interests of the child.
Well, in today's world, how many people do you know, and I'm thinking about the people I know, how many people can easily write the $80,000 check for the kid in college? I don't know if anybody can.
Not many.
No, I mean, what is it? I mean, granted, families are smart enough to save up for this, but my family wasn't rich, and my mom saved up some death benefits for my dad, but the $3,000 was not a problem. I mean, it was not great, but plus between summer and working during schools, I made $1,500. I made like half my tuition, for God's sake. Name me a kid now who works at Christmas during the summer that makes $40,000. What the hell is he doing? Duh. I mean, we're not even on the same. I mean, price does. You kind of learn this, Kevin, when you're in my business, because people have a plan, right? And they think that they're going to just do stuff that they want to do. but price means a lot. I mean, for instance, Micron's trading 1,078. It's up another $14. And I've talked about Micron and how I thought it's kind of high. Well, okay, you might say, man, I think Micron's a buy here. But by the way, I'll buy some puts for. Let me see if I can get this up here if I can find any. I'll buy some puts for just to protect myself. And then all of a sudden, you look at the page and I've got the 900 puts, like in a 900. So that's, we're talking $180 away. They're not helping you much. 900 puts, like next week, are $14. And you sit there and you go, wait a minute. I don't think that this is all that risky, because I think it's going up because the guy from NVIDIA likes the place and all the other crap that you hear. But boy, the rest of the world thinks that this is pretty rich. The price you pay is actually an indicator. It's like, if you and I walk in, I don't know if either one of us want to fit in the Corvette anymore. We look at the Corvette, and a guy like you can say, I can afford the $100,000 for the Corvette. And the guy says, yeah, the insurance is like $20,000 a year. And you go, wait a minute. Do I have to chain this thing to the curb? I mean, somehow the price of insurance and stuff is like, it's indicative to you of what you're actually buying, right? So when you look at the price people are paying for your 18-year-old kid, you're wondering, how deep am I into these people? And do I really have to do this to go to college when I used to just be able to write the check? I mean, how deep are we into this mess? Every week I have a couple of drinks on Thursday night with a bunch of the young guys from working the exchanges and FINRA and places like that. Kevin, every one of them's 30, 50, 70 in college debt. Now, our parents are willing to do just about anything to get under that, and so are the kids. But how far can we push somebody? It all starts at price, and they can't boot Bo Schembechler out and say, get out of here for $4,000. Now,
it's price and it's cash flow too. You know, and that's part of the college equation, right? If I can get you the financial aid, then nothing's coming out of your pocket this week. Yeah. Oh, cool, let's do it. Oh, by the way, it's going to come out of your pocket for a long time after you're done. Oh, that's a problem. Some colleges are pretty amoral when it comes to that.
Well, what if Bo would have said to this guy, I'm going to say as moral and as tough as this guy supposedly was, what if Bo would have said, hey, idiot, it's not $4,000, it's $200,000? Then what do you think the guy might have said? I don't know.
He might have, but, also the I own you attitude. Is that's just meatheaded, that's just meatheaded stuff. A lot more coaches are out there saying, hey, I will look out for your kid's well-being. Now, they were full of crap too, because they really weren't in many cases. But, that was always the pitch to the family is nobody's going to look out for your son in those cases. Nobody's going to look out for him that more than I will. And truly, there still are some coaches who operate that way. And you know, so I think you know, look, part of being a good leader in any circumstance, and I know this is shifting a little bit off topic here, but it is germane to, you know, that
certainly it's certainly germane to the world today. So keep going.
Well, yeah, but part of being a good leader is helping people become better versions of themselves in as many ways as you can. So yes, you want to push people to be their best. You want to you want to coach them hard. You really want to do that. But you also want, and this is true of, you know, it's part of being a good manager in the business world. But you also want to help people grow. You want to help people develop their skills. You want to help people find things in themselves that they didn't know that they had. This is like one of the great parts. When I say I love my job, this is one of the great parts about being a teacher is, you know, there's people. I remember talking to a young woman who was graduating last spring, and I happened to bump into her on campus. I hadn't seen her in a couple of years, but I had her in a management class. And I looked at her and I said, "Do you remember what I told you after class one day?" She said, "Yeah." And what I told her is, "You don't know it yet, but I see a really outstanding leader in you. And you need to keep developing those skills in yourself." And she did. So, you know, that's what being a leader's job is. It's, you know, it's not being in charge. It's being, you know, it's looking out for the people in your charge.
But where does that, I think once you reach the professional ranks, I mean, you're going to have it's on many levels. I mean, there's going to be leaders, you know, I'll say a Vince Lombardi that gets the most out of you for his benefit and maybe ancillarily helps you out. You're not doing that for your benefit. You're doing that for their benefit.
You know what? I disagree with you. I do. Well, I think
I'm talking about there's psychic.
I think there are many who fit that profile that you just described. But, you know, this was one of the revelations of my lifetime, somewhere around age 40, is that, you know, being in important roles was not about me climbing the corporate ladder. And as soon as I lost that attitude, I became a way better leader in the process. Because, you know, when it occurred to me that, first of all, for my own happiness and enjoyment of what I do, but also for, you know, just for the purposes of just doing what's right, it is more about helping people grow and building teams, you know, getting teams together where people really enjoy work well together and enjoy working well together. And once you get that attitude instead, now that doesn't mean you don't push people. That doesn't mean you don't have standards. I don't, it's not all a touchy-feely exercise. You still have to push. But once you do it in that way, you really, first of all, you'll succeed more. That's sort of the interesting thing. When you drop the push for success, the obsession with success, you tend to succeed more, which is a very interesting but absolutely true phenomenon. But part two of that is that you just have a more fulfilling life. And so when I say you succeed more, yeah, you know, I like it when, you know, I like that people do something because it's the right thing to do, not necessarily because, you know, because it's not in their self-interest. I think there's a convergence of the two.
But when you add, I'm not saying what your jobs didn't have a profit motive, but I mean, in the last, well, I'll tell you what I used to hear a lot from John and Pete because they were on the edge of pro. Actually, well, Pete played 5 years in the Pro Bowl, so he wasn't on the edge. But they would say, and Katie, who was on a couple of weeks ago talking about one of the hospitals she was working in, and how I think since you got to dedicate your whole life to it, that most doctors really have the same attitude toward what they do as you do teaching. They want to help people. But Katie said, if all of a sudden you didn't see enough patients during the day, the person upstairs, he didn't give a shit about whether the person is cured or not, and you didn't see enough people. Now, Pete would tell me, because he went from team to team, and how, you know, if you don't realize that you're just a bag of balls, there's something wrong with you. I mean, all the Jan would tell me about how they, if you're hurt, they can't cut you if you're hurt, right? They got to keep paying you. But if you're on the bubble anyway, the minute you come back and say, I'm ready to go, you may still have a nagging injury, and all of a sudden they'll say, go out and run a 40. Ah, your 40 times dropped 2/10. We don't want you anymore and cut you because you said you weren't hurt. I mean, the stuff from the coach, I think in a lot of ways, wants to make the player the best he can be, but he's not running the show. I mean, and Pete played 5 years, and they thought, NFL, somebody calculated it up, you had to play 5 years to be vested in your pension. Well, they cut Pete like 2 weeks before the 5 years, and nobody would pick him up to screw him out of his pension. But Pete, being the smart guy that he is, had kept every one of his pay stubs, which I don't know how many people do, and he had an accounting firm go through it, and it turns out he was 2 weeks over. And he presented that, and he ended up winning his pension. So, I mean, I don't really want that attitude to make it to college. And once it becomes all scratch, I think it gets there. Plus, on the one hand, I mean, I don't know if things are changing.
What you're describing is just, you know, bad leadership or bad management practice. And I don't think that wins in the long run. I think it is your difference between Brian Kelly and Marcus Freeman. It doesn't mean Marcus Freeman isn't driven to win. It doesn't mean Marcus Freeman, doesn't push hard on his players and so on. But, you know, to every last one of them is saying that there's a genuine caring there, a genuine looking out for the players involved. And along the way, yeah, you know, sorry, you ain't playing today. You're not good enough, or sorry, whatever the disciplinary aspect of the job is. Whereas Brian Kelly, it was always about Brian Kelly. It was never about anybody else. And when it's all about me, not you, sorry, but I'm not going to perform at a high level for you. Not at the same level, not with the same commitment. And that, you know, that was Brian Kelly, that was Matt Doherty, you know, back, you know, quite a few, you know, a couple of decades ago now. Sometimes that was Bob Knight. Sometimes, Bob Knight was the other guy. You know, Bob Knight was just a schizoid character. But you know, there are people who played for Bob Knight who said, you know, this guy did so much for me, and I'll love the man forever. And there are others who say, you know, that whole season on the brink year that he had, it was always about him.
I knew a guy that played for him, and he hated him.
Yeah, because when it's about him, when it's you're, you know, when you have the coaches is pushing players by saying you're embarrassing me, you know, the response to that is, so what? You know, I'm not worried about you, coach. But when it is, when it's you can be so much better, and I'm going to show you how, that's a whole different attitude.
Well, I think we
and that, you know, it's a marked difference in how a leader approaches the job.
All right, I'm going to throw a shout out to our guys and you and me to a certain extent. Our buddies, our Notre Dame buddies, somehow have this. What did Mike Rico say of Ronald Reagan? He had a rearview mirror view of an America that never existed, or something along those lines. Our guys are still convinced that somehow or another, and probably because of Marcus Freeman, who seems like a special person, our guys are somehow convinced that we're not as far into the sinkhole as some of the other schools because of him. But unfortunately, and by the way, I agree with that, so I'm not pushing that the other way. But I also know that the year he loses 4 games and Black Rock owns 20% of the athletic department in Notre Dame, he's getting his ass canned, and they're bringing in somebody, and they don't care what he does to people. I mean, that's I'm concerned about that being the direction, Kevin. And once you go down that road, it's kind of hard to come back. I mean, I've seen it happen in my industry. It used to be auction market, making sure the customer was taken care of and always got the best bills. And now it's customers are dumb enough to not know that people are selling their order flow to the highest bidder. I mean, you know, we don't do that for people, but that's how other firms make all their money. I mean, once you get down there, I don't know, people just seem like they sort of have too much to do, and we somehow are in this moral relativism kind of world where somebody's stealing but not as much as the other guy. Or you see it in traffic. You see somebody held up for 2 seconds where he should have made a green light. I saw this last night. Well, he got to go through the red light because if he wasn't held up, that was his green. And no idea that, wait a minute, the light's red. I'm supposed to stop. I go back and forth about the stuff I see in Washington on kind of both sides, and I wonder, are they leading us down the road to ruin, or are they reflective of what we are? I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Are they stealing because everybody's stealing, or is everybody stealing because they're stealing? I don't know what came first. Maybe it's because everybody else is stealing and they don't care. It could very well be that. I don't even know. But, I mean, I look around and I go, man, this seems a lot different than I recall. It doesn't mean, like, the world we grew up in was perfect. I mean, sure as hell wasn't. But somehow or another, and stuff's just happening, and I don't even... I see people here get construction jobs and nobody's even working on them. I mean, I don't know. There's a bridge in my hood that they're not even doing any work on, and it's closing. I can't even get out of my neighborhood on a Saturday at North Avenue. And these guys in the back here are working for the city, and they're pretty good guys. They manage the subcontractors on these projects. I said, hey, what the hell's going on with the Cortland Bridge? And one guy here is real nice, and he's really bright. He goes, yeah, the guys got in there, and they found out they thought they could use this steel, and now all of a sudden they can't use it, and they got to go out for... I said, couldn't somebody have done that before you started? He goes, well, you would think so. I mean, there's incompetence I see up and down the line. I don't even know where it is. I see some of the stuff people say in Washington on both sides, and I'm going, God, you got to go home and listen to yourself on tape. That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. You know, people don't seem to care. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, I don't know why we're heading down this path, but well, we seem to be
because you know, I'm going to go back on the leadership thing because we have so much poor leadership. That I think that breeds the incompetence that you're seeing. And, you know, that... So when I said, you know, it doesn't succeed, it doesn't. It doesn't wear well for very long.
Yeah, but how do you come back from it?
Oh, God. You know, that's a real long-haul thing.
Yeah.
Because I've had to do it, so...
And what, I mean, what if the big guy upstairs gave us a break?
What's the old thing of, you know, starting with trust? You know, trust takes years to build, a moment to ruin, and you never recover. I don't know. I got to get the trust.
Yeah. Well, what if we get some guy coming from outer space, and for the next election, he says, "I'm going to do you guys a favor. I'm gonna clone George Washington, and he's gonna run as a third party candidate, and he's gonna win." Where the hell would the guy even start? I don't even know where you'd start.
it's an interesting process of where you start and how you go about doing it. But it's really, you just start at the first thing that jumps up and screams at you, and you just every day you're working something new, it really starts with. You know, what you have to be able to do is describe your future state. What are you trying to be? You know, it's visionary leadership, but, you know, what are you trying to be? Might take 2 years to get there, might take 3 years to get there. It might be Martin Luther King in the 1960s saying I want people to be judged by the not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. It is that kind of thing. And then everything you do is supposed to move you in that direction. And you have to be really diligent and really consistent about it. And, you know, it's Kennedy talking about going to the moon as part of his vision. And then, you know, pushing all the every technology initiative in that direction. It's that kind of thing. And it takes a really, really long time to turn it around. But we just don't. We don't have people who are able. And frankly, we make it very difficult for people to look beyond the next election or the next, you know, the next event or the next whatever. We do, you know, as a society, we make it pretty difficult to do that. But nevertheless, you know, we have so much short-term thinking, and it's the same thing that you see. You know, if all I have to worry about is my next quarterly income filing, then that's going to be you know, the whole reason for being in the business world, then, you know, if that's all I'm going to do, then, you know, that's going to shape my decision making. And that's one of the, you know, the total quality management practices that says you can't do that. You have to manage for the long term, and build consistency into what you do. And when Dan Janinas used to come on and he'd talk about some of the companies he visited and some of the ones that really impressed him, that was always their approach is, you know, I'm in this for the long haul. I'm looking to build long-term value, and they didn't worry so much about what the next quarter looked like.
Yeah, but how much
I think there's plenty of that out there. It's just not, you know, there's enough of it, and it's not in all the right places.
I wonder if and Hal and Larissa, the combination, not intentionally on their part, but and I guess I kind of always felt this way, but somehow or another, Kevin, and it's been, I mean, I've always said, you know, as much as I was not a big fan of Biden or Trump, I always got the feeling they're not the man behind the curtain. In some ways they are, but in some ways there's an overriding direction that's being driven by somebody. Something about, you know, for a long period of time we're going to have some people being able to borrow at less than a real inflation rate, and we're going to lie to people and say what the inflation rate is, and we're going to protect the long-term stuff. When Dan Janinas used to talk about these mid-sized firms, and I know you're very much into that, and oh, by the way, so am I. I wonder, can a firm like that really borrow 3-4% higher than their big-time competitors who got their nose up the ass of government? I'm not talking about, you know, just recently. Can they really compete against those people in the long run, or are they pissing up a rope? And from my end of it, I think in some regards they're pissing up a rope. I mean, I don't know that you can do it over the long pull, because it's just too hard to do. If the banks don't want to react to you, but they'll give money to this guy and that guy and the other people. I mean, last week.
I actually do think that there, there is a model for how you can go about doing that. Yes.
Well, I mean,
you have to be so good on the cost side of your business, that you outcompete people that way.
Can you?
But it's done.
But you're not gonna get me to argue against you, and you don't want me to anyway. You argue against me that some people have enough talent and enough drive to work around these boulders in the road. But in general, the boulders shouldn't be in the road.
Yeah, I won't argue with you there.
And I think the why should it take a special talent to run a mid-sized business when a blithering idiot can run a business with all those advantages and make millions and millions of dollars? I mean, the advantages are, I mean, yeah, the guy with the small firm might be able to get there. But well, God bless, he's working twice as hard as the guy doing 10 times better. I mean, that shouldn't be, should it? I was talking to one of the guys last week, and I don't really get people's shorts, but the guy's telling me, somebody said to him, he's looking for an apartment. And he goes, why don't you buy something? He goes, how am I going to buy something? I owe like 30 or 50 grand of student loan. And I said, by the way, what is your rate? He goes, I don't know, 6.5, 7. I go, wait a minute, 6.5, 7? When the government is paying like, well, they were paying what, 1? We're scalping our students 6%, for God's sake? I mean, what are we doing? Do we really want these guys to pay off that note, be able to save up for a house, buy a decent car? If we really want that to happen, we're not going about it the right way. I mean, I'm not into so much the, you know, pick and choosing who in student loans, but I would if the government had the money, I would seriously look back 10 years on people paying 7% instead of the 3 or 4 they should have been paying. Figure out the difference, take it off the principal, and if somebody paid that and already paid off the loan, send them the check. Make it fair. Don't make it the one guy who's still got it versus the guy who paid it off. That's insane. What are we really trying to help these people? No, we're not.
Well, and you know what? Are we trying to screw these people?
Yeah.
Is the question.
Yeah.
Or are we just oblivious to the consequences?
Which is worse? Which is worse?
Every time we do one of these major legislations, there are always people who are saying, "Hey, you're ignoring the consequences here. This is inevitable." And there's always enough voices that say that, and they do just get ignored. So are they getting ignored because people don't believe them and they think they're crying wolf, or are they getting ignored because, screw you, we're doing this and we want those consequences?
Well, during the COVID thing, when interest rates went way down, I keep using the guy's name, but I think Amazon and a bunch of other places went out and were able to secure some long-term financing at like 2.5%. There's no way that should be able to happen and people paying 7 on a student loan. No way. It just, in my opinion. Just saying. And the government went out and did it too. Right?
Well, and yeah, and so, you know, when it's the government intervening in the markets, and they are totally intervened in the student loan market, yeah, they're screwing citizens.
Which is, you know,
really encouraging. You can go back to what we said before. If you don't have to pay this year, then you know, what do you care? You know, there's nothing coming out of your pocket now, and maybe you believe in the promise of future earnings that are going to overcome it all, or maybe you just don't think that far ahead. But either way, you come out of it as basically an indentured servant for a long time, and is that really what we wanted to do?
Well, in
many ways, it's hard to believe we didn't do it on purpose, because we can't possibly be so stupid as to not see it.
That's my maturity, Kevin, or whatever. Maybe we become young again when we get older, but I used to think that this all just kind of happened by accident. Now I don't. And somebody somewhere, for some reason, thinks it's in their best interest to screw these people. Now, if they're the guy making the 7%, I can sort of get it. But if they're not, somebody's doing well here. Who's the somebody? Not just doing well. Somebody feels that it's... Is it because you can't... you can't leave a big firm and go demonstrate with a sandwich sign down the street against Trump, against Biden, against Johnson. You can't. Do we really want a country of indentured servants? Somebody maybe does. I don't. You don't. But I mean, you're right. It's right out there. This is what we're doing. Why? Whose idea is it? I don't know when Obama essentially combined all these loans together, the public and private stuff. How did that work? I don't know. Do you remember?
I don't remember the mechanics of it. No, not at all.
So right now, if this guy is paying his 7%, who's he paying that to? Is that going to the government or the private people or some combination of the both?
I think it's government owned.
Yeah, I think they brought it all into the government, right?
Yeah.
So the government is essentially scalping. Well, look what they did. I keep bringing it up.
It's our own government screwing our citizens. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, look. I still can't get over the Social Security letter. By the way, for you, inflation's 2.3. For us, it's 6. How do you have the balls to send that out to people? You think your old people are that stupid? Maybe we are. By the way, there's two kinds of inflation in this world, one for you and one for me.
And explain what appears to be an intentionally undermining of the education system.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like Chevy Chase. We got both, a pool and a pond. The pond would be good for you, right? I mean, you look at the, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny, right?
I mean, well, it could be both.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't hear, it's only Wednesday, and I probably have heard 15 times on CNBC, and Dan's got Fox on in the other room, so we try and watch them all, but Fox Business. I probably heard 15 times of how strong the consumer is. Kevin, anybody who's had one semester of economics, and if you ask them how do you judge a consumer in an inflationary period, they're going to go, wait a minute, it's kind of tough to do. Of course they're spending more than last year. How can they not be? Or the same amount? Because it costs more just to do anything. So how do you say the consumer's strong when they're paying more for stuff? How do you know what they're not buying? I mean, isn't this insanity? I mean, how does somebody who they're going to give... We're talking about somebody who's supposed to know something on TV or even on radio. We're supposed to know something, right? How does somebody not say, well, yeah...
Hey, wait. We are?
Yeah, we're supposed... Yeah, we are. Whoa. But, I mean, how do you not say, well, it looks like spending is strong, but, oh, by the way, the savings rate hit like an all-time low except for one of the COVID years. And, oh, by the way, credit card balances seem to be creeping up more than a creep. Don't those three things kind of go together when you start talking about health? And you might want to throw in what the prices are up versus the average salary. Don't you need like four variables here and not just the one?
Well, yeah, and so it's really, you know, we should be looking at volume, but there, you know, there are other indicators. And, you know, I think right now we're sitting in a weird economic place where there's a lot of really bad danger signs. And at the same time, there's other things that are, you know, that I think are good. Kenny mentioned that ISM is up again, and it's like 5 months in a row after years of being negative. Of manufacturing activity. I don't think, you can't hide new factories. If they're happening, they're happening. We are doing, you know, we are seeing...
Well, he was talking about loans to factories. That was Hal yesterday.
I'm talking about ISM, and Kenny brought that
up. Okay, because Hal was bringing up loans to factories seem to be creeping up as well, loans for construction and factories.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Are we in a race against time to get more manufacturing done domestically? Because we talk about K-shaped economy all the time. The Mayor Daley thing, the elder Mayor Daley. Good government is good politics, and good politics can be good government. But really, he was right. Good government is good politics. Well, if you know, in this case, I don't know if you want to chalk it up to government or you want to chalk it up to whatever you wish, but the idea, the push for more manufacturing in this country is good. It's good for the, for addressing the K-shaped economy. And if along the way we don't like the way a lot of it unfolds, okay, that's the way it is. But if we get a lot of people who benefit from higher paying jobs, then I would say, okay, that's good. Can we get enough people to benefit from the higher paying jobs to avert disaster? And that's a good question, isn't it?
Well, I would hope that without, you know, any presidents blowing up about it, they did it all, because they all do that. I would think that the COVID situation, with people having very long supply chains, I would think that just as a general rule, and you know more about this than me, to the extent that people couldn't get stuff of these long supply chains, they might be willing and able, or certainly looking around, to shorten up that supply chain, which would make perfect sense to most, wouldn't it? I mean, I would hope that if, General Motors, for instance, in a new car, not one of the new cars that I would like, has, 35 little motors in the thing moving seats around and steering wheels and all the other crap, that they wouldn't want to be sourcing those little motors out of God knows where, because guess what? You can't put the car out the door without the little motors. I mean, it's stuff that we never used to think of. So, I mean, I would think that there's a lot of that going on sort of naturally, I would hope, wouldn't you?
Well, you would hope, and I think that makes sense, but also, it's laid out pretty clearly as a matter of U.S. policy right now in the national security strategy that I sent you 2 months ago. You've read it, right?
Three times. Three times.
I know you haven't, because you don't think, but there's a whole section on reindustrialization, and, kind of the important sentence in there is the future belongs to makers. That has shown up, that has shown up in speeches, in Bessent speeches, that has shown up in Vance speeches, to industry groups and so on. Bessent just did a big speech last week that I would encourage anybody to listen to. It's about 40 minutes, so it's going to take you some time, but it's there on YouTube. And this is all policy stuff, but they are, it is all about the fallacy of, you know, everything that we've lost from offshoring jobs. What we've done in the name of cheap labor has really hurt us. It is basically a managed decline, because we lose so much innovation capability in the process, and there's a really high cost to that. And so, you know, they are trying to turn that ship around a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's going to happen whether or not Bessence opens his mouth or not. I mean, is it worthwhile for somebody to buy some stuff here
organically or not? That's a good question.
But my concern is, and I'm not saying that he doesn't know that. I'm sure he does. I mean, he may be working hard to get it. But I'm saying, if you and I decide, okay, we listen to him speak or somebody speak. I mean, go back couple of presidents, you know, you hear the same speech somewhere. But the idea is, can you and I, do we have the certainty to say we've got a certain amount of customers? I used to do this for Pullman, for God's sake. Do we have the customers in line? Can we get the property? Can we get the loan? How long is it going to take for us to be able to produce whatever it is we're producing? Is the sand firm enough for the day we're done? We're not going to change policy and all of a sudden go back to no tariffs and everybody's buying it from China again. I mean, is the mechanism there other than the speech? My concern is the mechanism is pretty tough.
And the answer on the time is, it's been over a year now and you're starting to see that. That's why you're starting to see that in the ISM numbers.
I'm hoping you're right, but I don't know that the certainty in the funding and everything is all sort of there. I mean, it's a tricky deal to open up a business. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, because I talk to my nephew every week, and he's in a metal something-something business. And a lot of what they do is, people who bought machines overseas, they do, if a part goes, they'll make the part, because you're going to get it from them a hell of a lot quicker than you are from Korea. Now, okay.
People are starting to 3D print them now, and they make their own.
A lot of these parts are, they're old. Anyway, but I'm saying, now the question is, if what you're saying is true, and I hope it is, now, is the guy who's running his firm, the guy's got cancer, so that's another issue, but if he didn't, if he looks at it and he goes around, he sells his salespeople around, says, all right, there's a good chance, with the help of what the people now in office are trying to accomplish, it looks to me like my business is growing, I really need to take a look at this building next door. And oh, by the way, these machines now cost $500,000. I need to be able to go down to the bank and say, my business is growing. I've always been a good client. What can you guys lend me? $3 million for 6 machines over the next 2 years at a rate that's okay. And at the end of 2 years, the policies haven't all changed again. And I mean, that's a slippery slope for a person to do. It's really hard to do. And there's a lot of stuff all along the way there, that there's a lot of what ifs. Now my question is, in addition to policy from the top, and I'll lob one out there, that the policy from the top is good, are all the stuff in the middle being taken place to the point where, oh no, you can't get a loan. Oh God, no, where's your house? You got to sign off your kid. You're not doing that. Meanwhile, we can lend somebody on 1,000 shares of stock $200,000 in a nanosecond here. I mean, is this all coming together in any kind of a way? And I don't know that it is. I honestly don't. Just saying.
Well, I think it's really hard to manage it to come together. So a certain amount of it is going to have to happen. You know, it's going to have to unfold organically. You can give things a push in a certain direction, but it still has to, it still has to happen, and you can't control everything that happens. I think that's partly what's behind some of the government investments in different companies, is to try and juice some things to cause them to happen. Again, not fond of that approach at all, but it is what's behind it. I think Trump is very unintentional. It was very intentionally not a free market capitalist. He's trying to push things, but again, it's, you know, you and I had a fairly, listeners would be interested in seeing some of our arguments offline. Okay. I think you may, you know, people are going to benefit along the way, and that may feel like, or may actually be corruption. But I think it's also following a strategy that is, you know, is intentional, with the understanding of, we go back to Mayor Daley, that, you know, if there's good government, just like Chicago, always corrupt. But when there was good government, you know, I once had somebody, an adult, say to me, I would never vote for Richard J. Daley unless I think he's going to lose. Then I'm definitely voting.
God. Well, you know, do we have Russell or Larissa? Who's on?
Russell's on. I see. Is Maggie's phone Larissa, or is Maggie's phone Maggie?
That would be Maggie.
Wow.
Nice.
Yes, it is Maggie.
Hi, Maggie. How are you? She's, welcome.
She's outside of her non-compete for like a week.
Yep.
Cool.
Maggie, you have to control all these. You have to control all these mails. All right, Kevin, take care.
I got to go see a doctor, but I'll be listening. So have a good rest of the way.
Say hello to the doctor for us. Maggie, you got to control all these mails. We need control.
Yeah, maybe.
Your dad and I do. That's for sure. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you? I'm between jobs right now, so I'm able to hop on for about an hour.
Well, good for you. Yeah. Good for you. Well, the
and we're honored that you were willing to give us an hour, Maggie.
Yes.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, what was the old job, and what are you hoping for in the new job?
The old job, I was the White House unit intern at NBC News.
Wow.
And the new job is I'm going to be a reporting intern at a publication called The Capital Forum that focuses on regulatory and competition policy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm going to be drawing upon her experience a bit more than I have in the past for us, because where she's landing for this summer, it does kind of match up with some of the things that we like to talk about.
Well, when you say focusing on competition and things, what exactly are we talking, like, about a think tank? Do we write stuff? Do we do stuff? Do we make stuff happen? I mean, where are we on that plane?
Like, it's a news company focusing on antitrust, mergers and acquisitions, labor, trade, and corporate investigations.
Boy, they got a lot of work to do. Yes. God, how many combinations and mergers can we talk about? We'll send you a list of about 15, won't we, Russell? Russell,
I've got enough ideas to keep her busy all summer. That's for darn sure.
You know, we could do to really, really mess with, which we would never want to do.
No. Don't mess with it.
Lou,
don't do it. Go ahead.
Lou is our guy who comes on Thursday, and he's went to Naval Academy and blah blah blah. Now he's an attorney. He was an agent, sports agent, real interesting guy. He sent us a list, and I think I sent it to you, Russell. The amount of mergers in the defense industry in like the last 40 years, I was so stunned. You would be stunned. They start out with like, what was it, like 150 companies, Russell? What are they down to, like 20? It's like unbelievable.
If 20.
Yeah, there's a lot of people making ammunition and this stuff. I mean, there's still some, but yeah. I mean, Honeywell's taken over like how many? Like half of them?
I can remember defense being very fragmented when I started out 30 years ago. And it does, there, I, to a certain extent, it
may have a,
but now, may, you know, when a, we put things out for bid, what do we get? Two yeah. response?
Yeah, I got a generational question for you. And I always talk without being young. Sometimes I say something stupid, like when you talk to young people, this is how they think. My generation was very free market. I mean, I had somebody at Notre Dame who was an antitrust guy, actually a priest, and he was, you know, lambasted patent laws. None of them ever worked. The wrong company always ended up with the patent. And he started out from square one. And then, you know, I went from there to the University of Chicago, and they were all Mr. Free Market guys who could possibly be. and the antitrust laws that, I mean, I can, you know, hell, we had to be able to recite the first part of the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act. And yet a lot of younger people, and I'm not accusing this, I'm asking you a question, they think that something like that, if Pete's hot dog stand buys Russell's hot dog stand and raises the prices, they think that's good business. They don't think it's a felony. What am I wrong in that assessment or not?
Let me think about that. I personally would say maybe there's like an unfamiliarity with like Pete's hot dog stand, like buying Russell's hot dog stand and like that being a felony. Simply because like there's not a lot of small businesses out on the street anymore. We see more like things like, I'm thinking of, for example, like Starbucks or like McDonald's or like even in the Chicago area, like Portillo's. So I would say there's less small businesses and like less and because there's less small businesses, there's even less familiarity with laws like that from a young person's perspective.
Well, there's a thing.
I never thought of it that way, but you know, people 20 years behind us, probably, you know, I had, you know, growing up, I had two or three local restaurants in Memphis that I would go to all the time. And then there were, you know, a breakfast place close to the university, Brother Juniper's, who was a disgraced brother who started his own breakfast place right outside of, you would love that. You'd have loved that place. You would have absolutely adored that place. But the point is, I don't think I really went to like a casual fine dining chain type restaurant until, you know, I was a grown up because they weren't all over the place like they are now. So the generation behind us is, and I compare this to Emmy, Maggie's sister, who, you know, everything, everywhere that she eats is a chain type place down at Purdue.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it never occurred to me till right now that the generation behind us is kind of used to very large companies, and they don't see the issue like we do.
Well, there's a quick
one. They haven't seen it play it out like we have.
Well, there's a quick one here in Chicago, and I don't know if you even noticed it, probably didn't, but there's a place called the Restaurant Depot, and there's other outfit called Jetro's, and they are purveyors, wholesalers to essentially small restaurants. And you know, and you go there. I actually have a tag from my restaurant near me, so I can buy stuff for the office in there. But there's another outfit called Sysco. Sysco is this big outfit that supplies restaurants by truck. So if you got a big enough restaurant, you just call these guys up and say, "I need chicken wings," and they deliver them. Now I think there used to be a lot of them when I was younger. There was Edward Don, and there was a bunch of other ones. And these guys have kind of sort of monopolized in that area. Well, about a month ago, I get a thing from the Tribune that these guys are buying the Restaurant Depot. They're like buying the remaining competition for anybody who could go pick the stuff up themselves. I didn't hear boo from any editorial anywhere saying, "Wait a minute, how does that happen?" I mean, nobody even cares. Nobody even knows what the hell I'm talking about. How does that? We're talking about the biggest delivery service buying the only place left that people could go get the stuff themselves. I mean, that's what I'm asking. That's a question that kind of I ask me. Does anybody even know when, you know, when the biggest airline buys the fourth biggest airline, does that mean it's okay for the second to buy the third because now they have to do it to compete, and all of a sudden you got one left and you wonder how'd we get here? I mean, sorry, I'm talking too much. But what level are these guys talking about? Would they be accessed if say, you know, Boeing wanted to buy Airbus, or would they be accessed if one restaurant wanted to buy another? What level are they focusing on? You don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. For like the company that I'm working at?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the one you're going to be starting with.
Like they're focusing on like mainly like really big companies. Like there's a lot of talk, like a lot of their coverage, which I've been reading this week during my time off, is like the Skydance and Paramount.
Okay.
And I'm being very careful about like what specifically like their coverage I talk about because it's all behind like a giant paywall. So I know like one thing that they published publicly is like the Skydance and Paramount merger.
Well, they're getting the approval or trying to get the approval in Europe this week, right?
Yes, I've been reading about that.
Because Europe has actually stopped a couple of these that we didn't. Didn't they stop? Russell, was it Honeywell and? Wasn't Honeywell and GE? What was it? They snapped a huge one over there that we were going to let go here. a while ago.
It's not coming to me, but I'll do some digging.
It was Honeywell and somebody that they didn't let go through. What about, again, I'm not trying to have you talk when you're not supposed to talk, but what about like hospitals and stuff and pharmacy places and pharmacy benefit managers buying up and down? I guess the question is, are they focusing on, to the extent you know, horizontal problems or vertical problems?
Mm-hmm. I would say mainly horizontal problems.
Okay, explain that to everybody, because you and I know what I'm talking about, but...
It basically means, like, companies... Like, this is what I think it means. I hope I'm right. I hope we're thinking the same thing. But it basically means, like, companies, like, at the top, or, like, at a certain level, like, buying each other versus companies, like the bigger company buying a smaller company. Like, the big companies, like, merging together.
Not exactly. But But you're pretty close. It's horizontal means me buying your hot dog stand. Vertical means I'm buying the guy who makes the hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Russell? Vertical means that I buy people in the supply chain so I can control the industry.
Yeah, the part that you missed was that the Maggie, I'm correcting you now like we're in the classroom. So no, the part that you missed is when in the vertical merger, like if I'm Coca-Cola, if I were to buy an aluminum company so that, you know, now I produce my own aluminum for the cans.
Oh, got it.
That's all right. No, I would have given you a solid B+ on your answer.
And then B plus is
not good enough for me.
I know it's not. But we have to leave you room for improvement.
Yeah, good point.
All right, let's improve.
The hey, what did you guys? I'll run this one by Maggie. Did you see the article yesterday, Russell, regarding the market and what hasn't happened since March of 2000? I had no idea this was happening. Some guy dug this one out.
What happened? I did not see it.
Last Friday, the S&P made a new high in S&P 500, and only 20 stocks in the S&P made a new high.
That is a narrow-based rally, isn't it?
The last time it happened was March of 2000, and like a week later, everything fell apart.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't think you can trade that way, because everything's always different, but I look at that and I go... Wow, I don't know what to even do.
We'll put that up among the United Nations of red flags for the financial markets.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting there going, what do I do with this exactly? What do you make of that, Maggie?
I'm not quite sure what I make of that. To be honest,
it's kind of like the K-shaped stock market.
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
yeah.
Hey,
that's a good title for this week's show. All right.
Well, even with Maggie, one thing I'll run by you because Larissa brought up some stuff last week. And now she's God, that lady is infectious. When she says something, it makes so much sense that it's every for the next month. It's I always have to every time I say something, I'm like remembering what she said for God's sake. She was talking about Maggie. This is right up your alley. She was talking about how. When people give gross numbers of like consumer spending and stuff, she goes, they make it sound like the consumer retail sales are up 2%. Okay, they make it sound like that's necessarily a good thing. But if the inflation is up 4% and your salary's up 2, it means, and she used the example that because the prices are up, the kids and I are no longer going to breakfast on Saturday morning. She goes, I am spending more than last year, but I'm spending it essentially on less. So don't accuse me of being healthier just because I'm spending. And she goes, I also got a little bit of my credit card, which I never have before. So she goes, don't confuse the two. And now everything I hear, Russell and Maggie, I apply into that. Because the other day they came out with the savings rate, how low it was at 2.6, and how credit card balances are up a little. And I go, that's what Larissa was talking about. She was spot on. I mean, and yet... The stuff you hear, everybody's fat and happy, right? Because guess what? The dollars are flying. But if the dollars are flying up 2% and inflation's up 5, nobody ever makes the what from your end of the world, Maggie? What Does anybody even talk about stuff like that?
Honestly, no, because most of us are still underneath our parents, I'd say. Like, I'm trying to, like, in my college age group, like, most of us still have, like, financial support from our parents. So I'd say, like, we don't really think about stuff like that.
Didn't they hike your rent?
They did hike my rent by $50.
Which, where's your rent now? I'm just trying, I want a percent number.
My rent went from 1875 to 1931.
That's not a huge increase. That's about a 3% increase. They're not passing it on to Maggie right now.
No, well, don't
I'm
see,
also but,
yeah.
I'm also in a rent controlled building.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Wow, in Washington they have those?
Yeah.
Sorry, Maggie. They have. We were looking at maybe buying her a condo, and there are tons of Section 8 type condos there too.
Wow, but now you pay your own utilities, I assume?
I pay my own. My parents pay my rent. I pay my utilities.
How much have they gone up?
Oh, not that much, honestly. I think it's like $150 a month.
Okay. The reason why I ask is our Monday lady, Nancy, who does mortgages for people, I asked her, what's the rates now? And she says to me, it's not about the rate. It's about where you're moving. It's about the taxes. It's about the insurance. And I go, whoa, okay. Slap me down, you know, when I deserve it, I guess. But, yeah, and she goes, yeah, the taxes now are a bigger chunk, whether it's 6.5 or 7. I would never have guessed that. But, anyway, I mean, it's you gotta keep asking the right questions now. But you're able to do these jobs in just in the summer, or do you continue doing them during the school year?
I do them during the school year. So when I worked at NBC as an intern, I was during the school year, and I was part-time. So I went to school full-time. I went to school on, like, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then I would work on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
And you're close enough where you just, you know, hop the metro or whatever and get around?
I hop the metro and get around. Where I like walk. I walk to school from my apartment. So,
you're at kind of a you're George Washington, right?
Yeah, George Washington.
So that's what is that like? Is it sort of like DePaul, like a city campus where everybody walks all around the place? But it's not like Notre Dame where it was off in one side and nobody ever left the place. I don't.
Yeah, I'd say it's more like a DePaul. I did tour DePaul when I was looking at colleges, and I actually got into DePaul. Fun fact. But I ended up going to GW. But
why would they not accept you, for God's sake?
I don't know. My grandfather actually went to DePaul.
Well, my stepfather went there for the GI Bill, and my brother got his MBA there.
Oh, cool.
Well, her grandfather did better. He played basketball.
Oh, he did play basketball. He's really tall. I was like,
you know, under when they actually had a basketball team.
DePaul, so who did he play under? Ray Meyer?
Yep.
Wow, Ray was a great guy.
Yep.
Yeah, I was like, I think he played basketball, but I didn't want to say anything on the air that I'm not sure about.
Yeah.
Well, back in those days, one of my original clerks was a basketball player from DePaul, and he was older than me, so I'm going to guess he graduated 71-ish, 72-ish. And Ray Meyer, they didn't even have you know where their training table was, Russell? There was this Greek restaurant, and they were the back room of the Greek restaurant. There were no dorms. There were no dorms. They lived in an apartment.
And you know whatever Greek restaurant, but that was, now it's a Starbucks.
Actually, it's a McDonald's.
Is it? See,
yeah.
We knew it. You just knew it was whatever it used to be. If it was a local restaurant, it's one of the chains now.
It was
exactly my point I was making earlier.
Yeah.
Exactly my point. Just saying.
Well, one of my clients and good friends is he's Greek, right? And most of those restaurants were Greek people, not all, but some. And amazingly hard work. And he worked in his parents' place over on the east side, like Hyde Park. And one of their regulars was the young Barack Obama. He came into place when he was like 20 years old. And my client was a kid, and Obama came in with his buddies, and you know, had coffee and breakfast, and was an okay guy, you know, wasn't an idiot or anything like that. And but yeah, the East Side used to have an awful lot of people wandering in the University of Chicago area. That's a kind of vibrant. Did you ever think about University of Chicago? It's kind of an odd area. I mean, you either like it or you don't, the Hyde Park thing.
Yeah, I'm looking at graduate schools right now, and I actually looked into U Chicago for one of their programs. And I ultimately decided against it just because it was only a year-long program. But yes, I've looked into U Chicago, and my doctors and stuff like that are also... I used to go to Comer's Children's Hospital for a thing that I have, so I'm pretty familiar with the area.
I mean, it's I wonder if you'd like it, because you like... You sort of like being able to work in the area around you. Usually there you're kind of locked in for kind of a year, but not saying you'd have to be, but I commuted over there for MBA, which was weird. And I just drove over and parked. So I never really got into the year. The only thing I would do is on Tuesday night I'd go play ping pong with all the Asian guys. I never beat any of those guys, though. They were pretty good. Like, way better than me, sort of thing. But anyway, so I'm so intrigued about your... I mean, Russell tells me about your college experience. It's so much different than mine. I wonder if I would have liked it better, being out and about and doing stuff. I mean, Notre Dame was like going to a service academy. You studied like hell for 15 weeks, and then you get out. It was nobody did anything like what you're doing, and I wonder if I would have liked it better. I mean, what you're doing, I find fascinating, actually.
I went to a really rigorous high school where basically, like, I had no control, like, over my own life with, like, I would wake up at, like, 6 a.m., I'd get to school, I'd leave at 6:30, get to school at, like, 7 a.m., study in the morning till school started at 7:45, go from school from 7:45 to 3 p.m., do my after-school activity, which lasted till, like, 5 to 9 p.m., then I would go home and study till midnight, then go to bed and do it all over again. And then on the weekends, I would force myself to wake up early so I could study even more. So I'd be getting up at, like, 8 a.m. on the weekends, like, as well, and, like, basically studying all day, or I had, like, some sort of activity. But I felt like in high school that I had actually, like, zero control over my time. And also, I went to high school with the uniform, so even, like, down to what I wore was determined by other people.
Oh, don't tell me it was the white blouse and the plaid skirt.
Close. We had different colors. Colors. But, like, when I was graduating and looking at colleges, I wanted a school where I could have more autonomy over my time and what I do. So I chose GW exactly for that reason. And then right when I graduated, I got my first internship, and then the rest is history.
I'm going to say when you're 30, you're going to say you did it just right. You got one that was good for a while and one different that was good for a while.
So I want to ask a question.
Go ahead.
So she's got, and I think that this matches up with a lot of things that we talk about on here. You know, what you're getting ready to be a senior, and you look around at the world. What, you know, and you mentioned graduate school. What are you really kind of concerned about coming out of college?
Oh my gosh!
Other than finding a job.
Yeah, that's one of the things. Honestly, the price of living. Like, I think about that a lot, because I'll no longer have the familial support, which I'm.
Yeah, we're cutting you off.
Yeah,
I think you get an attorney. He's not going to cut you off.
She knows she can always call dad.
Plus, you get to be on the healthcare till you're 26, which is a good deal now.
Yeah, I know.
Which is part of the reason why I'm going to graduate school now versus later. So I do think about things like that. But honestly, like, the cost of living. And, like, part of the reason why I chose my apartment to live in is if I choose to stay in the D.C. area, then, like, I'll be able to afford my apartment. Like, will I be able to afford it? Like, I don't want to have to move or anything like that. So,
how many of your friends, just off the top of your head, or my head, or whatever, how many of your friends are buried with student loans?
Oh, like, a ton of them. I have a friend right now who's from the Chicagoland area. I'm really active, for some context, I'm really active in GW Catholics, our Catholic organization on campus, and I'm vice president of it. I was vice president of it last year. I'm going to be vice president of it again this year. And one of my friends is buried in so much student loan debt that he can't join seminary to become a priest. Like, he has to go to the workforce first. So,
wow.
Definitely look at GW. Like, the student loans is a big problem because it's like $100,000 a year to go there.
Yeah, yeah.
Looks flat.
I always talk, I mean, I've mentioned this to Russell a few times, and maybe it's something the younger guys that we once in a while have an adult beverage with. You wouldn't know anything about that, I know, but we have an adult beverage.
I'm 21.
There you go. Okay. So, well, if you're here, you can pile it. And just the difference in attitude. These guys are working for some of the regulatory groups or the SIBO or somebody. I don't even ask, but somebody. And they're making, I'm going to guess, what do you think, Russell? 70, maybe 65, if that. And you get this.
Somewhere in that range.
Yes. This big chunk of student loan debt. And they have an idea. They absolutely will tell you they'll never own a house. They'll never own a car. They will be stuck in this regulatory role when they're 70. There's no, like, it's so different than when I came down there and everybody was going to be a trader. Nobody had any debt.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, the next day, you know, you got up and the world, even if it wasn't, you felt the world was your oyster. And I feel so bad for these kids. I mean, they're not kids, but they, mm-hmm. God, you know, they don't, when you look at, like, you know, if you got a young dentist that you see helping your guy out or something, he's never going to own a practice, or he or she. I mean, somehow or another, this is bad. You know, Maggie, I think you, by having the family help you out and being able to get the experience, I hope you realize that you're so far ahead of a lot of these people. It's scary.
Yeah, that's also part of the reason why I chose to go to GW, was to get work experience as well for when I do enter the workforce. Because, like, the point of, like, going, like, I preferably relate, the point of high school is to go to college. The point of college is to go to graduate school or to join the workforce. And it's like, to join the workforce, like, you need some actual work experience these days.
Yeah.
So,
well, what do you say? I'll give you some work experience for 2 minutes. We go to break, and we'll be right back. S&P futures down 15. NASDAQ futures up 21. We just had the labor numbers from ADP come out at plus 122. We have our regular numbers on Friday. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Hello, North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Allen, Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 15. NASDAQ futures up 18. So we're pretty much slow this morning, at least so far. Dow's down 196. That's mainly because of, what do we got here? IBM's down $9. J.P. Morgan's down 3. Got Sherwin-Williams up 11. I'm not so sure. Everybody must be going to paint their house. But at Caterpillar down 355. So generally some downwards in the Dow here, but not horrible. Remember, when you see these Dow's numbers, I think the multiplier is right about 7. So if a stock is down $10, that's 70 in the Dow. It's a lot. It's not like the other indices. So got to be careful when you look at the Dow. DAX down 220. That's 0.9%. Deluxe owner Akzo Nobel plummets 18% after takeover talks fall through. Sounds to me like Maggie's group told these guys, no takeover for you, or something like that. FTSE down 36.4%. CAC round down 24.3%. So generally down in Europe, but not horrible. Asia, Nikkei up 1,600, wow, 2.5%, 68,402. We have to make sure we ask Russell, what in God's name, if there's inflation, if there's problem with the currencies over there, why are they at record highs? But they are. Hang Seng down 405, 1.5%. Japan's Nikkei hits record high as Asia markets rise amid Middle East concerns. Well, they're not too concerned, evidently. Bonds up 4 basis points, 4.49 again in the 10-year, right back up at 4.5. The Bund over 3.04, up 3.01. Japan up again 2.65, a little bit. Oil up 253, back up to 96.29. We were in the mid-80s last week. Brent up 231, 98.31. RBOB up 3 cents, 318. Again, add somewhere between 85 and a buck 10, depending on your tax situation. That's probably what you're paying at the pump. Gold down 35 bucks, was up yesterday. Just can't get a rally hanging in there in gold. Silver down a buck, 74.51. We got crypto, which has been getting hammered. 54 bucks today, 67,011. Kind of wonder, with the dollars flying into the system, why gold and crypto aren't going up, but they're not. Foreign exchange, dollar's actually a little stronger here, with the euro at 116, British pound 134, but here's one that Russell will comment on, I hope. Yen banged through this 160 level. It's back down to 159.99 or 89, but that 160 is their panic point. Andrew, what do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
All right, it is 7:37 here in Chicago on Wednesday, June 3rd. Nothing but losses, there we go, for our sports today. The Cubs lost the Athletics 1-2, the Sox lost to the Twins 4-6, and the Diamondbacks lost to the Dodgers 6-5. For Chicago weather, it is currently 67 degrees. We're going to have a high of 76. Over in Phoenix, they got mostly sunny skies. They're going to have a high of 79. Excuse me, they're currently at 79. They're going to have a high of 108. And for Chicago traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 25 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 41 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolfson is going to take you 43. And a bit more going on the Dan Ryan. There was a car fire blocking the right three lanes of the Dan Ryan heading local west before Cermak Road. The fire is gone, but the traffic is still definitely built up. The inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 57 minutes. And then finally, the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 45 minutes. Back to you, Chief.
Hey, Maggie, a quick question on the place that you're going to work, the guys working on the mergers and stuff. Is the focus, as you can tell, looking back at maybe a few that shouldn't have happened and try and break them up, which is a really hard thing to do, or looking forward saying these are the kind we're not going to allow? Do you have any sense of that?
It's more like covering, it's a news company, so it's more like covering current, like, deals.
Okay. Without any kind of opinion as to whether they should be allowed or not?
Yeah, without any kind of opinion, absolutely not. It's a news company.
Okay. But I imagine as you work on it, you'll probably have an opinion, saying, hey, well, how's this one, or this one long, this one looks good, yeah, or this one doesn't.
That's kind of how it goes, but I make sure not to insert my opinion into my reporting.
No, we don't want anybody intelligent putting their opinion out there. God help us if that happened, right? Just saying. Russell, what's going on in Japan? Why, if everybody keeps talking about how things are not so good, but markets are making new highs all over the place, is it strictly a money supply issue? What is it?
Yeah, it's you know, I was at an event a couple of weeks ago where an economist was talking about how, you know, some inflation is good for asset prices because it pushes them up. And I just wonder how much of a contribution of, you know, inflation, which they did not have for most of my lifetime in Japan, that is, you know, the adjustment for that is what we're seeing in their markets. And that's a function of, you know, part of it's a function of some of the fiscal policy stuff that they've been doing, where they've started to allow, you know, inflation to suddenly pop up when we say they had no inflation, they had products that were like, you know, 79-cent tea because it was the same price for so long, and now they have to change the names in addition to the prices, or maybe they just changed the prices.
Well, we have the dollar stores. We got to change the name there, right?
Well, I just had the exact same thought. as I was saying, that was like, yeah, you go to the dollar store now, and there are things that are more than a dollar.
They should change it to a buck and a half store or something.
Or a buck and a half, yeah. Or just used to be a dollar store.
Yeah, God, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't, hey, on a macro topic, did you guys talk about what the largest owned asset in the world is now? The U.S. Treasury market has been surpassed by the gold market.
Really?
Yeah. I really do believe some of the gold price appreciation has been central banks diversifying away from U.S. Treasuries, and that's one of the places, a liquid place they can put the money.
Well, how do you ever? I mean, again, you know, this. I mean, I say this to a fault. It's still not in everybody's vernacular, especially if you're from the Midwest like me, and you guys. The dollar in your pocket is always your staple. It's not in your brain. You're not hardwired to see when the price of a beer goes up, that it's not the beer going up, it's the dollar going down. I mean, we're just not hardwired like that. But in fact, is that's the truth, right? Is it's not the beer going up, it's to value the dollar going down is priced into the beer, correct? But how many people have any clue that that's what it is? You just don't think that way. And you wonder, we had a big email back and forth to people on the show, because Hal's been beating the drum about, and this is pretty, you guys, when he's done with this study, sorry, Meg, when he's done with this study, Russell, you guys should probably talk, because, I mean, you're on different ends of the economic professor spectrum, and he is putting together some kind of a study. Meg, bear with me on this. Where he is not only looking at the increase in the money supply, which, well, Milton Friedman's day, which he warned against because it's never even, blah, blah, blah. Inflation is good for some people, not good for other people. And we all know that. We've gone over it a bunch of times. But Hal's digging in there. He says, if you combine the increase in the money supply and the way the Fed's doing it now, with paying interest rates on reserves, and you combine it with the new banking laws and practices and mergers in the banking industry, Maggie, that's how I'm getting to you. You're finding the landscape is totally different, not just in the increase in the money supply and the devalue of the dollar, but who gets to access the money at interest rates that are really lower than the inflation rate. Which, if ever you can do that, even an orangutan makes money, right? I mean, if the market's going up 7% a year and the three of us can borrow at 1%, duh, you know, I mean, and he's putting this together. He claims that that's why one of the reasons the market is going up, because it's the easiest place to get credit. And when he looks at where the money's actually going, the money is in, help me here, Russell, it's non-regulated, in other words, it's financial institutions, not banks, which essentially means brokerage firms. That
and shadow banking type companies,
yes.
Probably.
I mean, last month the FINRA margin debt was up $80 billion in 1 month. So, and when you talk about like a Micron going up from 300 to 1,000 in like 4 months or whatever the hell it is, we're talking $600 billion on people's sheets. In their equity, I mean, somebody might have the certificates at home, but they're few and far between now. But if you've got stock here at PTI, at Micron, and it's up, if your stock is up $30,000, well, you have $30,000 of buying power. And, oh, by the way, you can call me or you call my brother for this. Say, I want to buy $60,000 worth of stock. We RBC or IB, will give you a loan for essentially $60,000 in a half a minute.
Yeah,
try and find.
I mean, you just have to. Yeah. Basically, I wonder how much of that capital is untapped.
Probably a lot.
You see what I mean?
But it's potential. Obviously, yeah, some of it is being tapped.
That's kind of where I'm going with it. Is, you know, if it went up by $80 billion, how much more can it go up?
A lot
before they. Yeah, but yeah, there's a lot of upside. There's a lot of potential upside, which would just exacerbate a lot of downside.
And Hal's point is, that's why you see, you know, the market going up. And his point is, for the three of us, even if we brought Maggie with, as, you know, to help our loan application, how long is it going to take for the three of us to get a $100,000 loan for a plumbing company? 6 months?
Yeah, you basically would be going hat in hand to every financial institution until you found one that might say yes.
And you'd be signing away the house and Maggie and the wife to get the loan. Yeah, I mean, you'd be
risking all of your own livelihood.
Yeah,
for that.
So I mean, I never thought of that until Hal brought it up, mm-hmm. and it's something I wonder. You could probably expand on it mentally better than I can, but it really has got me in a whole different place of how I'm thinking about stuff. Between Hal and Arissa, they've totally messed up my mind lately. Just saying.
That's good. That means you're alive.
yeah. So what do you make of that? I mean,
make of which aspect?
Well, that plus what's going on. I can't believe that this guy, you know, I don't even know the dude, but this guy, why does this guy that runs NVIDIA make me so nervous? He came out the other day and said Marvell's going to be the next. He doesn't have anything part of Marvell. It's not like he's the CEO of Marvell. He said this could be a next trillion-dollar company. Stock's up $62. Did that guy buy stuff the day before?
Possibly.
I mean, what the hell? What are we doing?
If not, maybe, you know, I think the higher likelihood is that his wife did.
Oh, God. You're probably right. But, I mean, what are we doing? Is there a moral left anywhere?
No. There's really not. You know, I guess, you know, you suddenly, maybe I'm reaching that age where I figured out the world, you know, that the whole every game is totally fixed and I should just be happy with my station in life.
Boy, you can't ever give up on that, though.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, there's a part of me that I say that with a smile on my face.
But then again, you managed to instill morals in your children, I can sure tell.
Oh, you know, no, Maggie is grounded for the summer. You wouldn't believe what she did.
Oh, God.
You know, I'm kidding. I could hear her laughing from the other room.
How do you ground somebody in Washington? How do you make that happen?
That's what webcams are for.
Oh, okay. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, God.
And she has a giant cardboard cutout of herself on a Roomba that she just leaves in her apartment when we said she's grounded.
Well, absolutely.
Well, yeah. My former producer, Maddie Weber, as his girlfriend, this is interesting, Maggie, because she's very nice, you know, sort of, and she's a great second baseman on a softball team, right? Because she played college ball for Georgia or someplace, and Maddie's a pretty good center fielder. So they break up, and my brother goes, "Which side are we on? We could always find another center fielder." We can't find an all-star girl short or second baseman. But anyway, we kept Maggie and she was gone. But Maddie loses his phone one night coming out of some basketball game or something on the way to the bar. So the girlfriend says, "Don't worry, I can locate it." It locates it like in a snowbank out in front of the basketball gym. And I go, "Matt, does that bother you at all?" And he goes, "Yeah, it surely does."
She knows where he is all the time.
I never even dreamed that.
I know.
I wouldn't want kind of a locator on me, and I'm sure you don't do that to Maggie. You can trust her.
It's a big contention in my marriage.
And what?
That I don't have the locator on. I just feel like I would. It's not like I'm running around doing anything that I don't want anybody to know about, but I would like to have a little bit of, you know, personal freedom.
Yeah, it's a...
You know, that's all. We have so little in this day and age, you know. Everywhere we go, we're on camera, et cetera, especially Maggie in D.C.
Yeah.
They're watching you. They've got their eyes on you, Maggie.
Yeah, I know. Like, my locator is shared with my mom and my sister.
Mm-hmm. Maggie, do you ever watch, like, the Bourne Identity, where whenever he walks into a shopping mall, first thing he does is scout out the cameras and realize where the dead spots are, and he only walks in the dead spots?
No, I've never seen that before, but that sounds like something I'd do.
Yeah, if I knew how to do it, I'd do it just for laughs. I mean, not that I'm doing anything, but, you know, it's interesting that because this is boy, it's an old grumpy guy talking. Just because somebody wants to know what I'm doing, even if it's boring as hell, I don't want them to know. Is there something wrong with that, Russell? Am I messed up?
No, but I do think it's more, you know, we've got, you know, a couple of generations on here. I think that's a generational thing. You know, it's, yeah, we were, this sounds so stereotypical, and
I'm starting to think that generations after us don't believe this, but we were pushed out of the house and told not to come home in, for a couple hours.
Yeah.
With no destination. You know, it was like, go do something. Yeah. Part of it's for us to get out of their hair, et cetera. But we, you know, we were probably the last generation that would just go on walkabouts because that's what we did.
Well,
you know,
plus
whereas
it was
now
our...
everything is extremely planned and you know where everybody is all the time.
Well, so, plus it was our job to get the eight people together you needed for a basketball game.
And stuff like, yeah, you had to go from door to door.
I mean, it was...
basically, you know?
I would feel so uncomfortable now. I mean, I guess it was just a wacky story, but when I worked for Pullman, my office was essentially in Hammond, right? But I was a financial program manager of the Boston commuter cars, which we were building in at the Pullman plant here on the south side. So I would go into Hammond in the morning, and then when I couldn't find out what I was supposed to be doing there, I was kind of getting bored, I'd get in the car, and I'd go to the place 111th, which took me maybe 25 minutes. And nobody had any idea where the hell I was. You know, they couldn't find me in the car. It was so refreshing. And then I'd get over there, and I'd kind of hang there for a while, and then if I had enough to do there, I'd go back to Hammond. And I was always, they could never find me either place. It was so refreshing to not have anybody know where the hell you were. Can you imagine that today? Where is he? We can't find him. He must be going to the other place. I think
people that have a bit of that as part of their lifestyle are probably the happiest people among us.
Yeah, I mean,
No, really. Yeah. You know, they're still, so... Yeah, you know, if they're willing to, you know, go out and spend time by themselves and do exactly what they like, and not feel the need to post about it, those are the people that are living their best lives, not the ones that are showing us that and trying to convince us they're living their best lives.
Well, this
yeah.
Well, Maggie, when you're done with, I think this, I'm getting the feeling that the jobs you've had with NBC and with the new place are. Mind expanding jobs. Do you want to stay in the press area, or are you just being in this area to learn what's going on and benefit from that, and then going to do something else when you graduate?
Oh, I definitely want to stay in the press area.
Oh, you like it? Okay.
Yeah, I like it.
Do you see yourself the next Mario Bartiromo on TV, or writing articles, or covering stuff, or where do you find interesting? Where's your spot?
Yeah, I want to be a foreign correspondent, but I specifically want to be writing articles.
Okay.
I always, when people ask me, I always say you want to do very deep work.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You want to do, you know, you don't want to do, like, you know, daily hits on the news.
So you want to be the Pulitzer Prize, you know, article, the copyright article.
I highly doubt I'll win a Pulitzer, but
don't sell yourself.
You never know.
Yeah.
You ever seen a movie? Was it Whiskey Fang Tango Foxtrot with my favorite lady in there from Saturday Night Live? What the hell's her name? Oh, where she was a correspondent in Afghanistan. You ever see? You should probably check that movie out.
Okay.
Just when, because she got over there and she was a correspondent about the war, and as it came off the third and fourth page here in the U.S., in order to get it back on the second page, her article, she'd have to go to more dangerous and dangerous places, and more people killed, the only way you get on the front page.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, you're sitting there, I'm going, I'll bet this is absolutely true. And,
yeah.
I don't think you want to be over covering the Ebola thing.
Yeah, well, maybe. I don't know. I want to get my hands dirty.
You're gonna put your mom in an early grave, honey.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but the rest of us like you too. I don't wanna lose you, and we only met you a couple times.
Oh, I'm not worried about Maggie at all.
There you go.
Yeah. I don't worry about her safe. She has great situational awareness.
Yeah, I just got back from a 3-week solo travel trip to Asia, and I came back alive, so I think I know what I'm doing.
Good for you. Hey, at some point, there's a guy. We have two guys that are on the show on Thursday, and one of them's in Florida, Wayne Madsen. But Andrew Craig, excuse me, he's still in Washington, and he's an older guy. He's an attorney, and he has written several books. He's kind of a whistleblower, historical sort of dude. And he's been a reporter. He went to Colgate, Russell, and then he was a rower. He's a big guy. At some point, I think you'd love to meet him. All the stuff you're talking about, he's done. And his mother, I'm sure she's not still with us, he was actually born on the south side about 2 miles from where I lived. And his mother got involved. She was a reporter of some kind, and she was writing on medical advancements. This got to be in the 50s. And she ended up going on missions to the Amazon looking for plants that had drugs in them that could help people with the people there and writing about it in the Amazon. And her poor dad must have been like, how did I get involved in this? And she ended up being a CIA operative down in these areas because, hey, if you're going to talk to all these people, you might as well tell us what you're... I think you and he would have fascinating discussions if that's what you want to do. He's a really good guy.
That'd be interesting. You could send me his contact information.
I will do that.
We'll get it for you.
Yeah, we'll get it for you.
I think Maggie would be excellent in clandestine services.
I don't know if she wants to go to the Amazon.
Although saying that right now probably ruined any chance that she has.
Yeah, exactly.
Because now everybody knows.
Well, you know, but if you travel...
I've always felt like that. When she started, because GW is... I don't know if you've seen a gentleman named John Kiriakou who... he's the one that kind of outed the waterboarding and went to jail for it for a while, and now he makes all the media stops, et cetera. But he went to George Washington in political science, and it's actually, I believe the CIA recruits pretty heavily from her school.
It does, and I can, like, yeah. I'm not going to say much, but, like, it does.
Are you multilingual? They really like those people.
Sorry?
Are you multilingual? They really like those people.
No, I'm not multilingual now.
You do okay with German.
I do okay. I can, like, survive in Germany, but,
yeah,
like,
you do.
You're
not giving yourself enough credit on that one.
Are you better than Ein Bier?
Yes, I am better than Ein Bier.
What's two beers?
That's 5 years.
Okay, whatever. I mean, actually, one thing, now that you're 21 that you mentioned, Wayne has just published a book and CIA bars around the world, and I think a couple of them around George Washington. You could start hanging around in there.
Yeah, I'm not surprised about that.
He says there's none in Chicago, Russell. We're skunked.
I wish I had known that back when SIBO was sending me around the world, because I would have. It just would have been nice to just lurk around in the corner of those places. Well,
there's a couple around the United Nations.
Yeah,
there's a bunch in Washington, as you might guess. But
yeah,
we're totally skunked in Chicago. So there.
Well,
now there's no summer school. You're home free to September.
I'm taking two classes to get ahead in credits.
So that means you graduate in December or no?
I graduate next spring.
Okay, so you're on the quarters.
No, we're semesters.
Okay, so you're not going to be able to graduate early, but you'll. I graduated early and I went to summer school, so I got out of quarter early in grad school, which was nice, but a lot of people are doing that in quarters, right? If you go during the summer, you can sneak back a quarter and graduate in, like, March or something.
Yeah, but, like, GW's not in quarters. I know Northwestern's on quarters, but I do have a lot of friends that are graduating in December. I just chose not to do that because that means, like, I'd have to find, like, a full-time internship while I'm waiting to go to grad school and, like, those sorts of things. So
when do you have to make the grad school choice? Is that it?
Next March.
Okay, so you got.
No, sorry, next April. My bad.
Oh, so it's not like early acceptance, like undergrad or anything.
Well, it depends upon, like, the program I'm applying to. So if I get, like, a certain fellowship, like, I'll know by November.
Who's in the running? Are there like five places, or you're still looking all over?
I'm applying to 10 graduate schools and 5 fellowships.
Wow. Is every one of the applications as big of a pain in the ass as it used to be? Writing stuff and everything?
Yes. I'm working. That's what I've been working on this week while I've been home.
What do they hit you up for an application fee these days?
Oh, it's like $50.
Oh, so it's not like $500 or anything?
No.
Okay. Why did I think it was more than that when I was doing it? But maybe they've cooled up. So who'd be, if you had to pick five from the top, who's your top five?
I prefer not to say because I don't want to, like, I don't know who's listening.
Okay.
Yeah, I know who.
Well, we got to ask because one of our young lady guests, Katie Mather, was in a couple of weeks ago, and she just got into Yale as a physician's assistant, but she's also, since she's done a lot of research, Yale wants her to do both, do research and be the physician's assistant, and what do they call it, the PA, and she John Hopkins won her, but she picked Yale for some reason. That's where she's heading. But she applied to four or five places, Northwestern, but she liked Yale, so that's where she's heading. In your particular major, are there some places? Have you just not figured out the particular major?
No, I figured out. I know everywhere where I'm applying to
okay,
right now.
Okay, fair enough. Well, then maybe when you pick one next time you're on, you can tell us.
Yeah, exactly. That's the plan.
Well, we'll have a reveal.
Oh, you have a reveal day. Well, that's fine. are you coming home at all this summer?
No, sorry.
This is it.
This is it.
This is it.
Well, now
yeah, Maggie's an international woman of mystery. We see her about two or three times a year.
Well, that's okay, I guess. As long as you keep in touch and
I call every day. So.
We we've got three trackers on her that she's not even aware of.
Oh god, those new shoes you bought her. You got a tracker in the shoes.
Honestly, that's probably not a bad idea.
Anyway, Maggie, I love having you. SP Futures down 17, NASDAQ Futures up 10. Russell, as usual, good stuff. I loved it, you guys. So we'll have you back certainly before the summer's over. Good luck on the new job. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.